From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, as a judge rules the NSA's actions unconstitutional, we look at whether whistleblower Edward Snowden could be granted amnesty.
I think there's other information Mr. Snowden has that could benefit the government. It knows how to communicate with him if it would like to talk about amnesty.
We have the latest on the Ukraine protests as support in Kiev swells to record numbers. The UN launches a $6.5 billion aid plan for the ongoing Syria crisis. And also today, two more detainees are released from the Guantanamo detention facility, reopening debate on when or if the site will close.
The president has been fighting these restrictions for a long time, claiming he has no power to release anybody from Guantanamo. I think today's transfers show that that's not the case.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. A U.S. federal judge has ruled that the National Security Agency's phone spy program is unconstitutional. He says the collection of data on all U.S. phone calls violates the Fourth Amendment and said the NSA must expunge the data they collected on the two individuals who brought about the lawsuit. The conservative judge expects the U.S. government to appeal the verdict. Meanwhile, a senior U.S. intelligence official tasked with assessing the damage done by Edward Snowden says he's open to offering amnesty to the exiled whistleblower in exchange for stopping further leaks. From Washington, Daniel Wrenches reports.
Rick Ledgett, the NSA official leading the task force to assess the damage done by Edward Snowden's leaks, thinks that among the estimated 1.7 million documents, there will be many capable of damaging U.S. national security, particularly if countries like China, Russia and Iran get hold of them. Ledgett is thought to be among those likely to take over the NSA director's job from General Keith Alexander, who's retiring soon. And Alexander told CBS's 60 Minutes that amnesty would only encourage others to steal data.
The United Nations is asking the world to donate $6.5 billion in aid for refugees of the Syrian civil war. It is the largest appeal ever made by the UN. The money will go to help millions both inside and outside the country who are struggling to survive the winter months. Quinn Bowman reports from New York.
More than 9 million people in Syria are in desperate need of aid, victims of the protracted civil war there. UN Refugee Commissioner Antonio Guterres says a majority of the Syrian population could be in need by the end of 2014. A recent study from the International Rescue Committee found the price of bread there is up 500% in the past 2 years. The aid would also go to 4.1 million refugees who have fled Syria, now living in nearby Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and Egypt. It's part of a $12.9 billion U.S. dollar campaign with which the UN hopes to help 52 million people around the world. Valerie Amos, the UN's humanitarian chief, says the crisis is one of the biggest in modern times.
The president of South Sudan says that government forces are in control, following what he called an attempted coup. Salva Kiir has imposed a curfew in the capital, Juba, after fighting broke out between rival groups from different tribes within the military. East Africa correspondent Justin Natal says the violence is a dangerous sign for the young African nation.
Clearly, if the ethnic sentiments are whipped again and again as it has been happening, there's a big potential for total chaos and this young country might end up in a failed state.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Chile has moved back to the left by re-electing former President Michelle Bachelet as their leader once again. She will take over from conservative President Sebastián Piñera in March. With 62% of the vote in her favor, this election turned out to be the most decisive victory in 8 decades of Chilean elections. Latin America correspondent Andrea Arenas reports.
More than 93% of the votes have been accounted for after this Sunday's presidential elections in Chile, where Michelle Bachelet was voted in as the new president of the South American country. The opposition, Evelyn Matthei, leader of the conservative Independent Democratic Union Party, only had 37.7%. In her campaign, Michelle Bachelet promised to improve education and work for equality. In 2006, she became the first female president to rule Chile. Her administration, which ended in 2010, went out with an 84% approval rating.
And Google has acquired Boston Dynamics, a company known for developing super-fast animal-like robots. Boston Dynamics also has strong ties to the military. Rachel Silverman has details from San Francisco.
Boston Dynamics has built a strong reputation for making heavy-duty robots that can run as fast as world record sprinters, climb walls like geckos, and jump as high as 30 feet. Much of the technology to develop these robots has been funded by the Pentagon, with an eye toward making robots that are battlefield ready. Google says it does not plan on becoming a military contractor on its own, but will honor existing Boston Dynamics military contracts. This is the eighth robotics company purchased by Google in the last 6 months. Analysts say these purchases show there's a rising interest in robotics use by consumer internet companies. Online retailer Amazon recently announced plans to deploy a fleet of delivery drones. Rachel Silverman, San Francisco.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. A federal judge has ruled that the National Security Agency's data collection program is likely unconstitutional. Monday's ruling follows comments by an advisor to NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, urging the spy agency to contact his legal representatives over the possibility of a future amnesty deal. It comes after an interview on CBS's 60 Minutes show, in which the senior US intelligence official tasked with assessing the damage done by Mr. Snowden said he was open to amnesty if there were no further leaks. The comments were all the more interesting because the NSA's Rick Leggett is also being touted as the most likely successor to his boss, NSA Director General Keith Alexander, who isn't open to amnesty.
This is analogous to a hostage taker taking 50 people hostage, shooting 10, and then say, if you give me full amnesty, I'll let the other 40 go. What do you do?
The NSA granted 60 Minutes unprecedented access, acknowledging that they believed about 1.7 million documents had been taken and expressing concern about the possible future damage to US national security. Our Washington correspondent Daniel Renches asked Snowden advisor Jessalyn Radek of the Government Accountability Project what she thought of the CBS show.
You know, I think it was basically an opportunity for NSA to have a public relations platform to continue to smear whistleblower Edward Snowden and shamelessly fearmonger to save face after being caught lying to Congress, the courts, and the world. It was basically an NSA infomercial, in my opinion. So I think they also gave a platform to NSA to engage in more character assassination, of Snowden, complete with unsubstantiated claims that he cheated on a test and that he could put a virus on NSA systems, which are totally unsubstantiated and which we had not heard before.
You're someone who's visited Edward Snowden in Moscow and indeed has been involved in advising him. Would you advise him to come forward when a new NSA director is appointed to negotiate on possible amnesty?
Well, a new director certainly knows how to contact Edward Snowden's attorneys and make that overture, and I would welcome that. I think amnesty would be very appropriate for someone like Mr. Snowden.
The terms described, possibly, would be that there were no further leaks. It's my understanding, though, that all of the documents have already been given to selected journalists, and Edward Snowden doesn't necessarily have any more control over the issue. So how would that be possible to negotiate an amnesty on that basis?
I agree. That would be problematic. And normally amnesty is not conditional. So the government would have to figure that one out.
So it seems a bit unlikely then, if those conditions were to be demanded, that any kind of amnesty deal would be possible on that basis.
On that basis. I think there's other information Mr. Snowden has that could benefit the government. And, you know, it knows how to communicate with him if it would like to talk about amnesty.
Do you see this as a possible opening then for a government that is more willing to, in a sense, make a deal, more accepting of the fact that the genie is out of the bottle and that they now need to move forward in a different way?
I think that would be a step in the right direction. And if the government means it, they certainly know how to get in contact with Mr. Snowden's legal advisors here in the U.S. to facilitate something like that. Unfortunately, the superiors of Mr. Leggett seem to disagree, and those are the people who would actually need to grant amnesty. So I would hope maybe that a new director might see it otherwise.
I just wanted to ask you about the General Alexander's argument about not offering amnesty to Edward Snowden, because it might set a precedent for other people to then come in, steal data and make another deal in the way that potentially could unravel in this situation.
Well, I think General Alexander should worry more about the precedent that NSA has set for global spying on anybody on the planet who are totally innocent, including entire populations of allied nations, with no probable cause or reason whatsoever to do so. And the precedent that that sets for the worldwide debate we're having on surveillance of the planet by the National Security Agency.
And do you have any more information about how Edward Snowden is feeling about all of this at this time?
Yeah, I think he's considering to pursue all options. Obviously, you know, he needs to renew asylum in Russia, and then we'll look for other asylum or similar kinds of grants elsewhere that might be a bit more consonant with his way of life.
Jesslyn Raddick talking to FSN's Daniel Renches. This is FSN Reports. Ukrainians are continuing huge protests in the capital of Kiev, demanding the resignation of President Viktor Yanukovych. Ukrainians in their tens of thousands have been angered by their government's attempts to abandon a trade pact with the EU. The European Union has suspended work on an association deal in reaction to Viktor Yanukovych's handling of the situation. And for more on this story, I spoke to FSN's Moscow correspondent, Tom Barton.
These protests in the middle of in Kiev, in the central district there, really gathering quite a character of their own now into their third week. They've never really stopped through all this time, and it's the third weekend that hundreds of thousands of very angry Ukrainians have come out just to show how much, A, they don't want to be in Russia's orbit, they do not want echoes of the Soviet Union and control over them in that way, and B, how angry they are at President Viktor Yanukovych and what they see as a very corrupt and cowardly government that doesn't listen to their wishes. We've got figures as well coming more and more to fame within the protest movement in that central square. The ex-boxer Vitaly Klitschko, now a very well-known face inside and outside of Ukraine increasingly. Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who was a former minister of the economy and also now a very prominent opposition leader. A very famous pop singer, Ruslana, who has been standing on a stage sometimes for 5, 6, 7 hours at certain times, constantly singing to try and keep up the spirits of the protesters. And the daughter, speaking today, of Yulia Tymoshenko, the jailed former prime minister. Many people see that trial as politically motivated. The government obviously sees it differently, but a great pressure amongst them and from her daughter to try and get her released. And we hear more interesting stories around the protests as well. People going into their offices to do their normal jobs and then coming out of their offices in the evening to give support to those that are protesting around the clock.
Can you just explain to us what role Russia has played in terms of this protest movement and Mr. Yanukovych's decisions regarding EU ties?
Yes, Russia absolutely key when we talk about this issue. As I was saying earlier, many of the protesters in the square, in the centre of Kiev, very angry at Russia and holding placards saying things like, "Putin, go away and never come back." Carl Bildt also has said more than once that he sees pressure, propaganda and threats coming from Russia, and that they are trying to keep Ukraine, which many Russian politicians make no secret of the fact that they still consider that it should be somehow in their sphere of influence and they should have some leverage over Russia, that should be maintained. And that is not a position that the protesters want. And some other EU spokespeople, the British Foreign Secretary William Hague, saying, look, it doesn't have to be a zero-sum game. So that when Yanukovych goes to Moscow on Tuesday to try and get more concessions, ostensibly to get concessions relating to economic aid, the gas price that Russia supplies so much of to the Ukraine, to try and help with its very struggling economy, a lot of observers outside in the EU see that perhaps Russia may try to put some kind of pressure on. In return for what economic aid they will give, they may demand essentially that the EU process of integration is stopped. And that is really what is at the heart of this international, some have called it a tug of war, others have called it a crossroads for Ukraine's future.
Tom Barton in Moscow. The US Department of Defense announced Monday that they released two more detainees from Guantanamo Bay and transferred them to the government of Saudi Arabia over the weekend. 34-year-old Saad Mohammed Hussein Qatani and 48-year-old Hamoud Abdullah Hamoud were incarcerated at the island prison for 11 years and were never charged with any crime. President Obama vowed in 2009 to close the prison. For more, FSN's Alice Olstein spoke with Shane Kadidal with the Center for Constitutional Rights, an organization that represents many of the detainees remaining in Guantanamo.
Well, a lot depends on where they go. When people get sent back to Saudi Arabia, they get to fly on a Saudi aircraft. They're not all shackled up like they were on the way over to Guantanamo. And Saudi has a very good sort of rehabilitation program to work people back into civilian life and a good support system. You know, they'll buy men a house and a car and help them get married and all these other things that help them adjust to civilian life. So great news today for the two Saudis. But that's today's transfers. A week or two ago, two men were transferred to Algeria, and that's a completely different story. So those guys were shackled on the flight over. They, like all the other Algerians who have been sent back, were immediately transferred into indefinite secret detention, which usually lasts about 12 days. Our understanding is that one of our clients is out, although he's very ill from his period of time in detention in Algeria. And I think most importantly, those guys didn't want to go back. One man who was transferred back, Belkacem Bensaya, he's been transferred to a country he's barely known, where his family doesn't live, where his wife and children aren't located, and who knows if he'll ever manage to get out. The problem is basically the attitude towards risk that the government indulges in when it sends people home. It's basically a zero-tolerance approach. They say that it has to be absolutely certain that nothing bad will happen, that the person won't do anything bad after they're sent back. And as a result of that, they require the local governments to monitor every last movement of these men, to make them report to police stations and things like that, to be under kind of constant surveillance. You know, regardless of whether there's even a shred of evidence against them when they were brought into Guantanamo, these are the conditions that the U.S. insists on when they're sent home.
And for those who have been sent back, most of them never charged with a crime, held without charge or trial for more than a decade. You represent some people who are in that situation and then are trying to seek justice post-release for their incarceration. What opportunities are there or possibilities?
Well, there's very, very little. We've represented a number of different types of clients who've been released from Guantanamo and who've sued for damages, trying to get some vindication of the fact that they were unlawfully detained and abused. You know, the courts have basically been completely unwilling to hear their cases. There are a variety of kind of immunity doctrines that the government argues in every one of these cases. And we have a case that's still pending, and I think it's just about the last damages case out there, where a number of the clients won in their military panels back in 2004. But you know, even the three guys who were among that group of 38 who won those very hard-to-win panel proceedings, their cases, the district court has said, ought to be dismissed, and we're fighting that on appeal now. If this case goes the wrong way, I think no one will have received any kind of vindication for what happened to them in detention or for the fact that they were wrongly detained in the first place.
There is some expectation that this latest National Defense Authorization Act that the Senate is expected to pass this week could make the transfer of Guantanamo detainees easier or more possible. Can you explain?
Sure. So in January of 2011, Congress put in place some very difficult to meet transfer restrictions that basically said that the Defense Secretary and Secretary of State have to certify, they have to essentially sign off on a piece of paper saying that there is no risk that anything bad happens after someone gets transferred, which, you know, is a metaphysical impossibility, right? And so as a practical matter, that made it next to impossible to transfer people out of Guantanamo. So the president has been fighting these restrictions for a long time, claiming he has no power to release anybody from Guantanamo. I think today's transfers show that that's not the case. The president did have power to move some people out of Guantanamo despite these restrictions. But there's a compromise version of the newest defense funding bill that basically loosens these transfer restrictions a great deal. Should make it much easier to transfer people. Basically, will kind of reimpose the kind of conditions that existed under President Bush.
And I know your organization has still been critical of President Obama for repeatedly saying he supports closing the prison without taking some of these steps that you say he can take, even with the restrictions.
You know, basically, 90% of the blame falls on the president. You know, we've talked a little bit about Congress putting these transfer restrictions in place, but, you know, they only started to do that in April or May of 2009. When the president was very clearly refusing to spend any political capital to defend his decision to close Guantanamo.
Shane Cadidal with the Center for Constitutional Rights. The UN has launched a record $6.5 billion aid appeal to tackle the effects of the ongoing Syrian conflict. The appeal for the humanitarian crisis gripping the country is the United Nations' largest to date. The UN estimates nearly three quarters of Syria's entire population will require humanitarian support in 2014. Earlier, I discussed the aid plan with FSN's UN correspondent, Quinn Bowman, in New York.
Right, Kevin. So this is what the UN describes as the largest ever appeal for a single crisis. UN humanitarian chief Valerie Amos asking the world to donate $6.5 billion U.S. dollars to help pay for aid for Syrian refugees. Now, there's basically two different types. They're what the UN calls internally displaced Syrians. There's some 9.3 million people that fit that category. They are either fleeing or hiding in place because of the violence in their country. More than 6 million have fled the country, we've got a serious need for help for them as well. They're living in countries like Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and Egypt, and some of these people are living in huge tent camps and are in serious need of help, especially considering the winter months that are here and will persist for the days to come.
We had the president of the International Rescue Committee described the Syrian conflict as the defining humanitarian crisis of this century so far. What can you tell us? Can you give us some specifics in terms of the conditions Syrian civilians, Syrian refugees are facing?
Right. So, in addition to being in a war zone where, both the rebel groups, the disparate rebel groups, and the government are, constantly in conflict, you've got a number of other factors. It's become a sub-zero temperature freezing in Syria thanks to the winter months. We've also got mass starvation in terms of access to food. The International Rescue Committee has released a survey showing that there's been a 500% increase in the price of bread over 2 years. In addition to that, there's people are having trouble accessing clean water. And if that wasn't enough, there's also an outbreak of polio in Syria. So just the problems of the civil war by itself, we have much of the attention is focused on dealing with Syria's chemical weapons. But the UN has been talking about this for months, that there are millions of people in Syria that are in desperate need. And the UN estimates it's possible that more than half of the population will be in desperate need of help by the end of 2014. So that's why they're making this big push for money. And the last time they asked for money, they didn't really even get all of it for the last year. So this is an ongoing problem. And the UN is making as strong a case as they can that billions and billions are needed to help save lives of civilians caught in this conflict.
Quinn Bowman in New York. This is FSN Reports. The UK is publishing draft anti-slavery legislation with tougher sentences for human trafficking. The Modern Slavery Bill is the first of its kind in Europe. Earlier, our Washington correspondent Lorna Shaddick discussed the proposal with FSN's Ollie Barrett in London.
Well, the UK in 2010 had an Anti-Slavery Day Act, which established an annual Anti-Slavery Day in the UK to raise awareness of the issue, and it described slavery as trafficking for sexual exploitation, child trafficking, trafficking for forced labour, domestic servitude. So these are the kind of issues that the government is now trying to enact further legislation to try and get on top of here in the UK. It's obviously a very difficult problem to get on top of because of the issues involved. There is a major report which has just been commissioned by the Home Office, and it suggests that this is a very extensive problem for the UK. It estimates that there are 10,000 victims of slavery in the UK at the moment.
And so what would this new legislation do exactly?
Well, it would consolidate the various offences which are currently used to prosecute those people who enslave others into a single Act of Parliament. It would, among other things, increase the maximum custodial sentence for offenders from 14 years, as it currently stands, up to life in prison. The draft bill also aims to create a new post of anti-slavery commissioner, and this person would have the job of holding law enforcement and other organisations to account in their efforts to try and get on top of the modern slavery issue. Of course, modern slavery is an incredibly hard thing to spot sometimes. It often goes on for a long time without being identified. It's also hard to define and varies widely from case to case in many circumstances. And so as a result of all of that, it's very hard to legislate over. And that is the challenge that the government is currently finding, is that pushing forward legislation to get on top of some of these issues is not an easy task.
Now, we saw the case in the UK recently of those women who were allegedly held as slaves in a property in South London for over 30 years. Is this related to that incident at all?
Well, yes and no, really. No, in the sense that legislation had already been in the works before that case and those allegations came to light. Yes, in the sense that that story, that case did bring the issue of modern slavery right into the forefront of people's minds. It dominated news bulletins. It was on the front pages of newspapers for a long time. It was a hugely high-profile story and still is as the investigations into it continue. And therefore, in a sense, the government does particularly want to be seen at the moment to be doing something about the issue of modern slavery. And perhaps it also feels that this is a moment when the attention around some of these issues can be capitalised on as it moves forward with this process of legislation. The proposals that have been outlined by the government have been published, wouldn't be law until 2015 at the earliest, though. And the campaigners on these issues say that many of the proposals need beefing up before they become law. They are welcoming action, but they are saying that the draft legislation doesn't focus enough on the victims of modern slavery. And they say that if you don't engage and involve and attract the support of the victims of these issues, then you will not be able to properly tackle the problem of modern slavery in the UK.
FSN's Ollie Barrett in London. And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us via email. We're there at reports@featurestory.com and on Twitter @featurestory. Coming up on Tuesday, the budget battle continues as the bill heads for Senate approval. That's Tuesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.